Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 16th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Frank Rogers. Today's session number is ROF98-1 and is entitled Practicing Our Faith Justly in Solidarity with the Marginalized. Let's listen in.
Just a couple minutes after 10:30, and so this is the cue for the tape. I am Frank Rogers, and this is Practicing Our Faith Justly in Solidarity with the Marginalized. And this is not to be confused with Jeannie's workshop next door. We have swapped rooms, so if you just realize that I'm not her, you can transfer quickly. But nor is it to be confused with Practicing Our Faith Justly, which is how it is written on the kiosk. I never heard of the word justly. It kind of gives a connotation of joyful gusto or something like that. And this is practicing our faith justly. But maybe that should be justly done as well. I know. I'd like first to begin with a short reading from the prophet Isaiah. Is this the fast that I choose, only a day to humble oneself? Is it to bow down the head like a bulrush and to lie in sackcloth and ashes? Will you call this a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? Is not this rather the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover them and not to hide yourself from your own kin. Then your light shall break forth like the dawn and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindication shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. I'd like to let those words just sort of percolate in our midst throughout the next hour. And my purpose is twofold for our time together today. The first one is, you have heard now about this book that has been sort of the theme of the summer's workshops here at the Holden Village, called Practicing Our Faith. I see a couple of copies of it hanging around. And I am one of the authors of that book. And I thought we might take a little bit of time at the very beginning just to give a basic introduction, orientation to the way of thinking that is embodied in that book, the way of thinking that really involves a way of being in the world, trying to reflect on what is distinctive about being Christian. And the fundamental premise of this book, that what is distinctive about being Christian is not what we believe necessarily. It's not the creeds that we mouth or that we orient ourselves to. What is fundamentally distinctive about who we are as a Christian people is the way we live our lives, the way in which we practice faith, put our faith into practice within the myriad of details and activities that make up the mosaic of each one of our daily lives. That is what it means to be Christian, is to practice living with a certain kind of character and quality to it. And I'd like to give a little orientation to that way of thinking, the way of being that is embodied in this book. And then the second thing that I want to do is to take that way of thinking and put it into the particular context of what does it mean for us to reflect on practicing our faith when we think about reflecting upon that from a particular standpoint, and that is from the standpoint of being in solidarity with the marginalized, with the persons who suffer oppression, injustice, woundedness within our world. And solidarity with the marginalized is another practice that we could include within the whole litany of things that make up the texture of Christian life together. So those two things are what I'd like to do today for our conversation. Does that sound like a plan? Okay. Well, what is this way of thinking and this way of being, practicing our faith? And the best way I can think of for me to orient us to that is to share a story. My son, Justin, when he was three or four, he loved to play pretend. He pretended his way through everything. He pretended to shave like Daddy in front of the mirror. He pretended to be Barney until that became a little babyish. He pretended to be Max the Wild Thing throughout the house, and he still pretends to be Max the Wild Thing, I think. But he just loved to pretend everything. And actually, to say that he pretended might be overstating it. I became worried because Justin would absolutely get absorbed in his games of pretend, to the point where Justin would get lost, I would think, and this character would be in our midst. Well, my worry crescendoed on the day that Justin literally became Peter Pan. For months, Justin stopped responding to the name Justin. He would only respond to the name Peter Pan. We would be dinner time. Justin, dinner time. He would ignore me as he's swashbuckling with Captain Hook. If I say, Peter, dinner time, in he would come running with the words, I get to sit next to Wendy. Absolutely lost in being Peter Pan. Well, one day I was a little relieved as I heard him walking by him say, Gaston, you are positively primeval. Which is a line from Beauty and the Beast. And I said, Justin, who are you right now? He says, well, I'm being Belle, and that Gaston is being very, very rascally today. I said, yeah, I can imagine. He says, of course, I'm only pretending. I'm pretending to be Belle. I'm really Peter Pan.
Much to your relief.
Much to your relief. Well, imagine my chagrin when Justin began to pretend then to become a Catholic priest. It happened one day after we went to Mass. We had come home Sunday afternoon. I got a lawn chair out in the backyard and kind of got upside the sandbox, and Justin went inside. He began to lose himself in playing with his sand toys, pouring sand into cups and teapots and saucers and buckets and having a good old time. And I'm reading the newspaper, and all of a sudden, Justin got a great idea. I saw him leap out of the sandbox, dash into the house, scurry up the steps into his bedroom, embrace all the stuffed animals he could get off of his bed, scurry back down the steps into the backyard, and began to place them along one of the sides of his sandbox. He finished those, ran back in to gather another collection. Back and forth he went, throughout the entire house, underneath the couch, in the closet, in the dirty clothes hamper, gathering every stuffed animal, every doll, every play figure he could possibly find, and he lined them all up until they completely surrounded his sandbox. Then he got inside the sandbox and put his blanket over his shoulders as a shawl, and with all of the dignity of a fully draped cardinal, he grabbed a teapot and began to pour sand into teacups. And he would put them in front of his animals one after another. The body of Christ. The body of Christ. The body of Christ. Down one row, down the second, halfway through the third. And then something awful. He ran out of bread. There's plenty of sand, but he had no more cups, no more buckets, no more saucers. He had run out, and there was still a row and a half to go. And I watched this poor guy as his head just sunk down onto his chest. It was like a cloud came over the backyard. Something absolutely wrong was happening. I just sat there and I threw out, what are you going to do now? Shook his head. And then I watched as his head came up, his face brightened like sunlight just came down on top of him, and he said, I got it, we'll share. And he took his animals and he clustered them into little groups of five and six around the sandbox, and then took a bucket of sand and put them within each group so that there wasn't enough for every individual to have their own bread, but there was enough for every group to have their own bread to share with one another. And it occurred to me as I was watching him, he wasn't pretending anymore. He had played his way right into the heart of what it means to practice Eucharist. Because the Eucharist is for everyone. All the scattered and battered
and tattered lot we can find and gather around the table. And we share the bread we have. And when we run out, we share what's left. We share what we have until there is enough for everybody to have something. See Justin playing Eucharist? Practicing being a Eucharistic people, playing Eucharist, is one of the practices, one of the activities that we as Christians participate in. It's one of the things that we do that makes up the contours of our lives. It's one of the games we play. It's one of the dance steps that we move to. And to be sure, we don't know always what kinds of obstacles we're going to encounter as we play this game. And sometimes we do it in fits and starts, and sometimes we just flow into it and play it like it were real. But the promise of this practice is that as we pretend, as we play this game, as we engage in this practice, we will find ourselves connecting with the heartbeat of what it means to be a faithful people. We will find ourselves becoming captured by that vision of bread being offered to all. We will find ourselves being moved to share the bread that we have. We will find ourselves participating in community that is ours. One of the promises of this practice, of trying to practice being Eucharistic people. Does that make sense? We engage in this practice, and as we do so, we are shaped and transformed and moved in ways that we would embrace as being faithful. Does that make sense? You see, Justin, and the power of that little anecdote, him practicing this faith. What we, as the authors of this book, suggest is that there is a whole constellation of practices that we as a Christian people embrace and are invited to participate in. And that constellation of practices is much like what Justin was doing with being Eucharist. They are activities and things that we do in the midst of our daily life, but we do them in a particular way that has a promise to them. That as we do that, we will find ourselves participating with the Spirit of God that is in our midst. And these practices are woven together to form and create a distinctive way of life. A way of life that has integrity, has meaning, has a whole integrated dimension to it that we could say has the character and distinctiveness of what it means to be Christian in our world today. A way of life. Does that make sense? So let's play around a little bit with this notion. Practices that constitute a way of life. Justin and I went to Korea this last March. And if I were to make this statement, tell me what meaning it would have for you. If I were to say that I was in Seoul, Korea, and I was amazed at how Americanized Seoul was. I mean, it was like the American way of life had just simply absorbed and wrapped up Seoul, Korea, so that everybody was practicing what it means to be American. I felt like I could have been in New York City with the way in which life was. The American way of life seemed to permeate that place. What connotations would you think I would be talking about if you thought about the American way of life? What would be the American way of life? Yeah? Fast food, yeah, McDonald's on the, Burger King, yes. So fast food industries.
Cars.
Cars everywhere, the mobility, and everybody in their own car. That's right.
Logo clothing.
That's right, absolutely. Nike and Just Do It and T-shirts and caps and Adidas and all of that, tennis shoes and, right. What other characteristics, qualities of American way of life?
Gadgets.
Many gadgets, just filled with stuff, things that do different things, yes, that become indispensable in our lives. I mean, how in the world would we live without that coffee pot shaped pencil sharpener that, you know, doubles as a cheese cutter.
Movie stars and entertainment.
Movie stars and celebrities and that fascination with Michael Jordan on billboards and all of that, yeah.
Tremendous number of churches.
Tremendous number of churches, absolutely, absolutely, which is true, certainly, of Seoul. And of Christian churches, too, in this Asian country, which says a great deal as well. Yeah. Other characteristics of American way of life.
Shopping.
Oh, strip malls and advertisements and commercials and things that we need to buy. That whole notion of consumerism that we just find ourselves wrapped up in.
Well, sports.
Sports being a huge part, yeah. On the billboards again, and on TV, and in the restaurants as the soccer games and basketball playoffs. And,
yeah. Losing our heritage.
Losing our heritage, yes. Becoming rootless, living in the now, in the moment, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm hearing a lot of themes, you know, the busyness of life, the competition in sports. We didn't mention really the business world and corporations that are kind of conglomerately taking over the world almost, and the heroes we celebrate. That are part of that. All of these different characteristics that make up the American way of life. Now, this is the air we breathe, is it not? As we get up in the morning and we participate in our lives, this is the culture that we just participate in. So let me ask, what are the different activities, things that we do in our daily lives that participate in the very things that we've been talking about? How are we part of this whole thing, the American way of life? Any of us shop?
Drive a car.
Do we drive cars? Yeah.
Computers, phones.
We collect gadgets. Yeah.
We own more than one TV.
We own more than one TV.
We want to be entertained.
We want to be entertained. And we go to movies and we watch. We pay for all these sports stars and celebrities that are all over the place. Yeah. We enjoy that. Yeah.
We enjoy our work.
We enjoy our work. That's right. Yeah. We spend a great deal of time in the pursuit of our vocations and the money and luxuries that it brings, but also the meaning that it gives to us. And that work that we participate in is often very integrally connected to the corporate business world, and it doesn't take too far. And we have Bill Gates's computers and marketing with strategies that Microsoft perfects. And other practices?
Physical fitness.
Physical fitness, that's right. Yeah, we try to look like the movie stars and the celebrities, and we have our own notions of what it means to look in a way that we celebrate, and we try to do that. Yeah, certainly.
Americans also practice religion a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We practice our religion.
We go to churches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Many of us, our primary communities are those. Yeah. You get just a taste of how the way in which we practice our daily lives nurtures and participates in a way of life, a larger identifiable fabric that shapes us and forms our values and our time priorities and whatnot. I mean, do you get the idea how that makes some sense?
Yeah. Is the assumption is that these are all negative things?
Not at all. Not at all.
I'm kind of bothered by that as somebody who has traveled a lot, because there are so many things. We all list the negative things right away, but there's so many things that are good that we can practice our religion, that with all the change in the economy, there's a wider variety of things we can do for our life's vocation. As a woman, I'd rather live in this country than anyone else. And it's so easy to focus on the negative practices when we define our culture and overlook the positive.
The freedoms that we have, and exercise is hardly just a negative thing. I mean, it's very mixed bag. I mean, part of that is a very is a way of honoring our bodies and maintaining fit and being more whole as people. Absolutely.
That's, are we free?
So. And are we free? I mean, that's. But I guess what I don't want to do necessarily is critique or celebrate American way of life. Rather, what I want to lift up is the way in which a way of life, in all of its beauty and all of its shadow, is constellated by activities and practices that support it and sustain it. We participate in that way of life in everything that we do, the decisions we make about our time, about where we buy our toothpaste and brushing our teeth and how, et cetera, et cetera. All of that creates a way of life in its goodness and in its shadow. And let's shift that to looking in its goodness and in its shadow. If we were to say, what is a Christian way of life? What would be the kinds of things that come to mind to think specifically about a Christian way of being? Some of the values, some of the characteristics, some of the qualities, some of the locations. A Christian way of life.
Thoughtfulness of others.
Being thoughtful and considerate of others. Yeah.
Sharing.
Yeah. Justin in the Eucharist is embodying a distinctively Christian value.
Worship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gathering in community to celebrate, to align ourselves with the sacred, to praise, to
witnessing in our daily lives
that the fabric of our own existence and the things that we do breathes of the things that we're talking about, sharing and worship.
What else? Recognizing interconnectedness, mm-hmm, among people and the different parts of life.
Yes, recognizing the interconnectedness that we all have one with another and the interconnectedness of the world and creation. Things come to mind? Christian way of life?
I think that the most distinctive thing about Christianity versus a lot of other religions is what you have up here, forgiveness.
Forgiveness. Mm-hmm.
That we just, sorry, okay, and move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we as a people seek to reconnect when there is brokenness and alienation, wounds in relationships. Well, we could probably continue and add, you know, things like compassion and like caring for others and all the other values that make up a Christian way of life more and less. But let me ask, what are the different practices, the activities that we do that nurture this way of being, that we as Christians participate in, that help us become, live into this way of being? What would be some of the practices that would come to mind to you?
Praying,
certainly. Practice of praying.
Visiting the sick,
yes. Giving care to those who are in need.
Yeah. Worshiping.
Worshiping is a practice, to be sure, yeah.
And both corporate and personal.
Corporate and personal, right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Within our families, I think passing on nurturing our value system.
Mm.
That first line with the people around you and your family. I hate family values, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's to pass on that way.
To share with the persons in our family, the things that we hold dear, the things that are important to us, the ways of thinking, the stories, the beliefs and whatnot that are very central to who we are. Yeah, it's another practice.
Volunteering time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, giving time, volunteering. Yes, in the service of God's healing and transformation of the world. visiting the sick and caring for the dying and etc. Yeah.
Responsibility with all of God's gifts and stewardship.
Yes, being responsible with the gifts that we have. Yes, material gifts included, but not just that. The other gifts that we have, the unique gifts to us as people, whether that be our art or the ability to organize or computer skills or whatever, to put those gifts in service of participating with God's work in the world. Yes, being stewards of the gifts that we have. Well, the writers of this book that got together, we did essentially this, is we sat around and we began to think about what are some of the practices that are important and central to who we are as a Christian people. Practices that have this peculiar promise in them that as we participate in them, we find ourselves, much like Justin did playing Eucharist, being caught by the vision of what is embedded in them and being transformed into the virtues and values that are embodied in these practices. And we came up with 12 different practices. And there's nothing particularly magical about these 12. We might have come up with 12 different ones in a different year or a different sitting. We could add others, and we've certainly named variations on the themes of these. But the 12 practices that we came up with, I lifted up on the board here. And just very briefly, let's say a word about each one. One practice we came up with was honoring the body. That we as Christians are invited to remember that our bodies are what Paul's temples of the Holy Spirit. Our bodies are sacred dwellings. And as sacred dwellings, we recognize that we are invited to give honor to our bodies. And we do that in a variety of ways. We recognize that our bodies are part of our worship in the way that we feed them during Eucharist, or we give them water during baptism. We touch one another during passing of the peace. But we also are invited to give honor to our bodies through the way that we care for them. The way in which we exercise, the way in which we tend to them, the way in which we groom ourselves, the whole issue of how do we adorn ourselves, the clothes that we wear. And we ask the question as a faithful people, what does it mean to give honor to our body in the midst of the cultural pressures to wear Michael Jordan logo hats and things like that, and to fit into supermodel looks and all of that? What does it mean to give honor to our bodies and to practice this? Is one of the practices that we identified. Does that make sense? The practice of hospitality is certainly a central one to the Christian and the Jewish tradition as well. That practice of embracing the stranger, of welcoming into our home the persons who are outsiders in our midst, and to make that a constitutive part of who we are. The practice of saying yes and saying no was the one that was preached on last night. And that is this practice that recognizes that whenever we seek to be intentional about becoming, fashioning ourselves as a people, it takes discipline, it takes rigor, it takes intentionality, much like athletics or much like an art in learning to play an instrument. And that intentionality and discipline requires us making some decisions and saying no to certain things and saying yes to other things. What are the disciplined commitments and disciplined patterns are we invited to as Christians is something we explore in that one. The practice of keeping Sabbath. Somebody once, in that chapter, there's the allusion to a group of people who were meeting on a Sunday, and somebody finally just said, do everybody think about how we are so bold about how we are sinning in our midst? I mean, here we are meeting on the Sabbath. It's one of those practices that we have the least scruples about violating often. What is keeping Sabbath all about? And that yearning we all have for rest and for renewal and for recreation, and how our own work is part of a broader rhythm of God participating in the world and God's own rhythm of work and of rest. And how does keeping Sabbath enable us to participate in that rhythm more fully? The practice of shaping communities. Communities require order and leadership. Certain roles and gifts need to be part of that. What does it mean for us to shape a community in a way that embodies the values and virtues of who we are as a Christian community, as a Christian people? The practice of forgiveness, the way in which we recognize that there is broken relationship in our world, and that that broken relationship, as a faithful people, calls us to yearn for reconciliation and to engage in the very difficult practice of wrestling with what does it mean to forgive wounds and to reestablish reconciliation, and how do we do that in the midst of very real pains of our world? The practice of healing, the way in which we recognize that when there is illness, that that is a distortion of God's intention for creation, and how our own participation in yearning for healing, in praying for healing, and in trying to nurture healing is a way of recognizing God's hopes and yearnings for humanity, for a humanity that flourishes. What does it mean to engage in the practice of healing in the midst of the various forms of illness that we experience? And the ways in which our efforts for healing embody very mixed bags as well. The practice of household economics. And what does it mean to bring order to our household? The economics by which we put together our own private homes, but also our planetary home. One of the quotations in that chapter, somebody said, to really find out what a person believes, just look at their checkbook. Where do we write checks to? Where do we spend our money? What are the gadgets we buy? What are the things that reflects our priorities? What does it mean for us as a people of faith to order our own households and to spend our money in a way that embodies the faithfulness that God is inviting to us? The practice of testimony is a practice that is particularly strong in the African American church, and the African American gentleman wrote this chapter for us. That practice in which we are invited to bear witness to that which we know is true. This happened. I know this to be a fact. And in the Black church, the practice of testifying to the way in which God has been good in our lives and bringing that before the corporate people is one of the practices that sustains that community. What are the different ways in which we give testimony? We tell the story of how God is part of our lives. Where do we do that? In therapists' offices and around coffee pots, we engage in the practice of testimony. The practice of discernment, which is that practice of recognizing that we all make decisions in our lives. Some of them are very easy and mundane. Some of them are agonizing. But the way in which we are invited as a Christian people to make the decisions that face us is to recognize that our decisions are one piece of God's invitation to participate with God's work in the world. So how do we go about making the decision of which car should we buy, or the decision of what vocation am I being invited to participate in ways that help us access those movements of God's Spirit inviting us to participate with God? The practice of discernment. The practice of dying well, of recognizing we as a Christian people recognize that we all die, but we also hold to the belief that death is not the end, that life continues after death. And what does it mean for us to engage in the practice of dying, our own dying, but also the dying of our community that embraces the faith that we all hold to? What is dying well all about? And lastly, the practice of singing our lives, which is one of my favorite chapters. The author of that actually is the father of the Indigo Girls, of one of the Indigo Girls, who himself is a liturgical theologian, teaches at Emory. But he says there's something within the human spirit that longs for song, that yearns to be expressed in music. And our songs take on various contours. Sometimes it's a song of joy and celebration. Sometimes it's a blues tune and the song of lament. But we all break out. Sometimes it's a song of inspiration, like during the Civil Rights Movement. But he laments, where do we sing in our world today? Singing is usually now only happy birthday or take me out to the ball game. But Christians recognize that singing is an important way in which we pray, in which we participate in God's own praying of the world. What does it mean for us to sing our lives? These are, so, I mean, just in a real nutshell, 12 practices that occur to us as forming a web, a way of being, that as we participate in these various practices, we find ourselves being shaped in and embodying the distinctive characteristics of what it means to be a Christian people. And we find ourselves participating with the Spirit of God, bringing healing into our world. That's, in a nutshell, kind of what this whole way of thinking and way of being is all about in this book. So, is that making sense? Or? Yeah? So what thoughts occur to you as you entertain this way of...
Well, most of our social relations, a lot of them come from economic exchange. And how do you practice these 12 items? And when you're just it's the superficial economic exchange of the marketplace. I mean, you don't do testimony, and then the economic exchange may shut down. Or even in social exchange, much of the social exchange is just associated with some offshoot of economic exchange. So, in, you know, we spend a lot of our daily lives working. Mm-hmm. I mean, the word itself connotates things. Just say it over and over again in your mind. Mm-hmm. Work.
Right.
Work. It's a very hard word that we have for it. It doesn't sing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do we do this in the workplace if we spend 10, 12 hours a day there?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's the question that's posed to us, is it not? Yeah, it's exactly the question that's posed to us. My own hunch, I mean, just my own observations, is that many of us who in our own workplaces yearn for a way of life such that our work has a meaning to it beyond just the cumbersome harshness of the word work. That there is a real spiritual malaise about our work, things that we do, spend so many hours of our day in, and don't have that sense that this is meaningful, or a sense of fulfillment, or a sense that this embodies some of the things that I hold dear in my life, or that as I work, I'm caught up in a rat race. I'm just swept away by powers that I'm no longer in control. I'm so busy. I'm so frenetic. That I long to come to a place like Holden, just to center and still and get the reverberating accelerator to slow down a little bit. Huge yearning, I think, for precisely a way of life, a way of being in work that is more sane and more faithful.
It almost becomes schizophrenic where you're one person at work and it doesn't agree with any of your sense of values. I mean, I have a job. Mm-hmm. I'm a preschool teacher and I get to do what I want to do. So I think I'm very blessed in that. Don't make much money, but but I do feel like it's in sync with my values and like what I said before about nurturing and it's that I love, but I live off my husband. He may be... It's not in sync with you. You know, I feel bad about that. You know, I kind of, okay, you know, I'll make some spending money, but you send me to Holden. That kind of thing. So I feel, I don't know if it's guilt or whatever, but I feel like I'm sort of a parasite. But I think he wants to be a preschool teacher, too.
Yeah.
Or have that kind of life that's in sync with his values.
Yeah.
Not that he's a mass murderer, but
he's
a but he's more, you know, more the business world.
Yeah, right.
Well, I just think never before in history has there been such a wide variety of ways that people can earn their living. And I think that's the good part about all this change. It takes a tremendous amount of courage, but I know so many people who are sick of that sort of discontinuity between who they are as a person and who they are in work. And so they're changing their work situation. They're starting their own businesses, or they're doing often very dramatic changes in their lives. And I think that's more possible and more acceptable now than it ever has been. But it does take a tremendous amount of courage to make that change.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an enormous amount of opportunity. I'm not saying that there's not.
Yeah.
But when you... I mean, what are you fulfilling when you do a job? Someone's tastes and preferences. And, you know, maybe that's not the best thing going on. Aren't they very ephemeral, people's tastes and preferences? But that in the marketplace that we created, to put your niche, you're satisfying tastes and preferences. Which may or may not have.
But maybe you're fulfilling a need. I mean, it's like where the world's greatest need meets with what you can contribute to it. You can look at exchange that way instead of saying, well, it's supply and demand or it's consumer. You know, there's other ways of looking at work, I think, that maybe sound resonates more strongly with me than just looking at it as a market exchange.
But it maybe has to do with the types of work that you're thinking about. You know, there would be some jobs that rise and fall on selling and appealing to consumer tastes and being driven by that. But by no means is every job necessarily determined in quite that way. Yeah. Do you all find people generally satisfied and fulfilled in their work, or generally frustrated or disconnected? That work is, you know, sort of the schizophrenic. It's something that you do, but you live for the weekend or live for time away from work.
I think the majority of the people in this day and age aren't happy, or they get themselves in situations where they can't afford to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're at such a point in their life that all their retirement benefits are locked into it if they quit and go into something else, or you're here and you drop off and you have to start at the lowest level all over again, yet that won't meet your basic needs.
Yeah.
But I read something the other day where they had some survey and there was I can't remember, it was over 50% of the people were very unhappy with their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't know with the context of it.
Yeah, but and that's very mixed. I mean, because you get settled in a way of being. I mean, you've got children and you're supporting them and you've got a house and you've got debts or you've got colleges in the future or whatever, and so it's not just as simple as I'm gonna quit my job and start, you know, following my bliss. It's very complicated. Yeah.
I think it depends on the day, but they do call it work. They don't sell tickets at the door. So
right. Yeah, the word work, I mean, itself has come to mean something dreadful. I mean, a harsh word. It's, you know, work is something that you endure to get to vacation, you know. But that is, I mean, but that is striking to the heart of looking at Christian life as a set of practices. Because, you know, in Christianity, we would look at work through the lens of vocation. I mean, what is the vocation to which we are called? What is that work of participating in God's activity in the world, are we invited to participate in and bring the unique training and gifts that we have so that our work is a place in which we are able to participate in the healing of the world or participate in bringing beauty and joy or reconciliation or fulfilling a need or whatever. Work is put in an entire different framework, has a different purpose to it.
I think it's one thing that helps me is to think of God himself as a worker God. And God worked in creation for 6 days. He labored and he rested on the seventh day. So God is a worker God. He invites us. One of the great gifts of being made in God's image is the gift of finding our vocation, mm-hmm. find what our gifts are and using them and taking pleasure in that.
Yeah.
So work is, from a Christian point of view, can be a great way of reflecting the Creator and enjoying being made in God's image. That, of course, there's a curse somewhere about work too, and we have to work that out.
I think one thing that I serve a congregation that is comprised basically of what have been labeled the quote-unquote working poor. And most of them are dissatisfied with their work or job, but not necessarily that it's just simply flipping hamburgers at McDonald's or service, or, but it's the way they are treated in that job that is, I think, dehumanizing, and many of them, I think, would find it humiliating. So that it's not necessarily simply what they are doing, but the way they are treated in what they do. And that's what makes it work in such a drudgery, heavy kind of style, because it's kind of for 8 hours a day or whatever, one is entering a world of being humiliated, dehumanized, and that, and it goes back to what you say about being in the world. There's a question there of, as Christians, do we understand, do we work, do we set up communities of work differently so that work is a good thing, part of the image of God, where we are truly human rather than dehumanized? I think that would be a very important question to think about.
Yeah, I think that is a very well said. Very well said. And I've seen the corollary to what you say as well. Persons who, for one reason or another, have limited gifts in terms of work, work in a McDonald's or work in a school or something where they're treated with such dignity and embraced and become such a part of that community that even though they are only flipping a hamburger or mowing the lawn or whatever, they feel like they're doing something important. They are treated with respect. They are treated as somebody whose gift of mowing that lawn or flipping that burger is as important as the one with the PhD and is the executive director or whatever. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And that sense of, I want to go to work, you know, that's where I go to feel empowered. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a big problem. I mean, a lot of people, regardless of whether it's a high-paying job or not, it's how you're treated at work. I mean, you could be making, you know, $500,000 a year, but if you're treated poorly, how long are you going to stay there? But I think it happens more often in low-paying jobs that's a real problem. But also is the attitude within yourself, whether you're, am I happy? Am I secure? Do I remember that I'm a child of God? And a lot of times that will help overcome the feelings that you're getting from around you. And to stop and remember, you know, where I am and who I am.
Yeah, that makes.
And you can have the most. See, I mean, I have a friend who, she's a potter. And she loves it. And I get to live at home. I get to be with my kids. I get to, you know, create. And yet, you know, she'll get an order for something, and she's on the fritz. She, it's hard. It's difficult. She's got to stay up late. She's got to get up early. She can't do what she wanted to do today. So no matter what your job is, even though you may choose it from everything you could be and you are what you want to be, you're still going to have periods of, oh, I hate this. So, you know, works that.
Right. I mean, the artistic process is an agonizing one. You know, and I'm thinking of, you know, Genesis 1, and God worked, created. I mean, I always think of that artistically. God is a potter, you know, who gets God's hands into soil there and fashions something and breathes life into it. But there's an artistic creativity that is going on. That, you know, that work, you know, I would love to see work being able to have that dimension where we are able to experience those creative energies that we have within us, whatever that might be, writing a sermon or making a meal or whatever, but that it brings beauty into the world and accesses that creative spark within us. But that is hard work. I mean, sometimes that's just a flow and it feels great. It's all in sync. Sometimes it's just really gut-wrenching and you're putting in long hours and you're trying to make that come and you're, or the training for that or whatever.
And your child's sick.
Yeah, and right, exactly. Oh, yeah. You've got competing demands and everything else. Yeah.
but how beautiful it is that we as Christians can walk by the fellow who's mowing the lawn or watering the flowers or painting the wall and say, great job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right. Doesn't that make our day as much as it does theirs, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And one way of honoring that, and another way, brings us back to larger questions about justice and so on. That if I see somebody, you know, theoretically, who's doing something that, like watering the lawn or, you know, cleaning something, also it, to the extent that I have responsibility in making sure they have a living wage, so that they can have, like me, have a family and have a roof over their heads. That's part of my way of saying great job and meaning it, is trying to make sure that they have a wage at the end of the day. And that's hard. And that has to do with the relationship between the strong and the weak in the culture and society and in the body. Mm-hmm. And Paul talks about that too, of mm-hmm. course.
That's right. And that does weave into, you know, the practice of what does it mean to practice these practices in solidarity with the poor, in solidarity with the marginalized one. Because that does break open the question. It's one thing, it's very easy for us who experience more privileged postures to be able to say, oh, that's great, well, let's celebrate the person mowing the lawn or making the meals or whatever. And, you know, we really value who you are, and you're a part of our community, and we treat you with respect and dignity, but I'm going to go home because I'm making $45,000. I'm going to a nice home, and I don't have to worry about meals, and I've got my two TVs, and that person's going to go home, and they've got three kids, and they don't have enough to feed them, and so they go to a second job, or they have to, you know, whatever. There's something unjust about that.
It's very unjust.
Yes, exactly.
There's a normal distribution.
Uh-huh.
Some people don't have the ability, and for them to be less compensated, well, Frank Sinatra, you know, has a voice that appeals to people, and he's compensated enormously. Seems to me to be fundamentally a problem.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's exactly where that practice takes us, is to wrestle with that deep question then of what is fundamentally just. Are we willing to engage in these practices and allow them to open up for us our own investments and securities and be willing to shift our own priorities? Yeah. One of the places in which this becomes real is in liberation theology. I don't know if how many of you are familiar with liberation theology, but liberation theology was a movement originating in Latin America, where it began to ask the question, what does it mean to be faithful in the midst of a very oppressed world, and the Christian responsibility to work for justice and right relationship economically and not just spiritually, but spiritually includes that. But one of the things that they have suggested is that if we as Christians are really going to try to bring about justice in the world in the midst of these situations and issues, then we need to really try to align ourselves literally with the persons who experience these forms of injustice, and not try to presume what we think is dignity and right relationship from our own perspectives. Because human beings have an uncanny, an insidious quality of always thinking that what's good for somebody else is just an extension of really what's good for me, and that we are resistant sometimes to allowing ourselves to really be challenged by what might be good for another. Does that make sense? This is so insidious that even liberation theologians can't do it very well. The patron saint of liberation theology is a guy named Bartolomé de las Casas, and he was a 15th century Spanish priest who, from Spain, went to Latin America and eventually became a bishop in Latin America. And he worked with the people in Latin America, bringing Christianity over to those peoples. He was also a very wealthy plantation owner. And he, as part of his plantation, used indigenous peoples as slaves. And sustain. In fact, the entire economy of the countries were dependent upon this kind of slave labor of the indigenous peoples. And one day he was reading the text that we read today, the fast from Isaiah. What kind of practice am I really asking of you? Yahweh asks. Is it not to set the oppressed free? And it all of a sudden dawned on him that he was living in a fundamental violation of the gospel, and that what he, as a person of faith, needed to do was to put his own beliefs into practice. And he became the forerunner for justice and freedom for those indigenous slaves. He fought for legislation that made it illegal for them to be indigenous slaves on plantations. He was the patron saint of liberation theology. His solution to the problem was, we don't need to have these slaves. What we can do is we can import people from Africa and let them be the slaves instead. It's a true story. 9 years went by as he fought for justice in the midst of the peoples of Latin America before it dawned on him that the black people of Africa were also human beings and also were within the reach of what justice should include. Even somebody whose heart is committed to the practice of justice and asking these questions is open to the blind spot of presuming what is just for everyone. And until we actually step into the shoes, step into solidarity with those folks who are experiencing that, we are ever going to be susceptible to just protecting our own interests and our own positions of power as we try to bring justice in a way that's not too threatening to us. The real challenging question that is posed to us is, how do we practice our faith in a way that really takes seriously the hard questions of justice for those persons, that goes beyond a superficial, let's love one another kind of thing. That hits us where it's tough to, where we struggle, I think.
Well, I think that one of the things is that we often look at developing countries and think, for them. But a lot of times I look at those people without all that stuff and all that responsibility, and they can go to the next village and they don't have to worry about securing their house and making sure that their animals are fed and doing all that. And they may, in fact, be far above us, but our mind won't let us think that. They may have a better life, but we don't think so, because they don't have the stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of it's just changing within this whole idea that we need stuff. And that's where this whole insidious advertising and capitalism and the American way is really there. I mean, there was something I read that I had never heard of before, but overdeveloped countries. We live in an overdeveloped country. We are on the bell curve. We have the underdeveloped people over here starving, and we have us over here over-consuming. But the good spot is in here. But we're like, and we don't quite get it, because we can't see beyond. We need more. I need a little more. I'm going to share. Give it to me so I can share. We just think that we've got it, and we can't move over a little to say, maybe we don't have it. Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't get it anyway. Mm-hmm. And maybe this guy over here with nothing is living the life that we're supposed to be living.
And I mean, it's very complicated, is it not? I mean, because we look at that person and we need to there's wisdom in those people, and there is virtues and qualities and ways of being that we have so much to learn from.
Right.
But yet also, it's easy to idealize. They're looking over at these overdeveloped countries and seeing the privileges, and there are very real ways in which they are beaten down and do not have the same access to medical care and all the other kinds of things, and they want to be like us, they want to be, the Americanization of the world kind of thing. What does it really mean to find that middle place that we all yearned for?
But so even in the idea of what do we do for the marginalized? Well, first of all, we figure out what is important to do and what is not important to do.
Yeah.
We come in and now we're turning back to natural ways of medicine and to all these things that we threw away because they were useless, and we've got the better way because we have science.
Right.
And now we're turning around and saying, well, maybe they had something there. So I can think it's partly too, just when you ask, you know, how do you, what was the title of today?
In solidarity with the marginalized.
In solidarity. Yeah. What does it mean?
Right.
Maybe one way to make the connection is to enlarge the meaning of the word body beyond our, you know, skin and bones, to as Paul does in the New Testament.
Right.
Maybe we need to push it a little. Ask to what extent the image refers to somehow being connected to people.
That's right. That's right.
Beyond ourselves and members of the body.
That's exactly right. And I think that's a great, you know, great observation to make, that really all of these practices, each one of them, when you get down into its heart, it reaches out into these broader questions. What does it mean to honor our body? Well, we need to recognize the other bodies of the world and the ways in which the way we buy all this stuff to adorn our body affects the way in which someone in these underdeveloped countries are able to ordain or to honor their own body, and that we are all one large body that needs to find a way to equalize. Yeah. I mean, that makes total sense. We cannot practice these without getting down into those deeper questions of how are we going to be a people of faith in the midst of all of the persons of this world.
I think maybe it also falls under shaping communities, because mm-hmm. I think trust is the essential thing that holds a community together. And I was reading, and I feel this is true, and the research has like proven it's true, but when you have rising income inequality within a community, it starts undermining trust and social cohesiveness.
Say it too.
When you have rising income inequality in a community, mm-hmm. over time, it starts undermining trust and social cohesiveness in that community. And it's often harder, I think, to be a marginalized person in the United States than it is to be, like you're saying, a developing country where you're marginalized, because you have that reference point to other people who have more things or more access to opportunity than you do. And I'm always so disturbed where we always focus on developing countries. I mean, it's so easy to say, well, it's really sexy to focus on sort of the whole world and help the developing countries, when there's so many marginalized people in our communities. And for some reason, it's harder for us to face that and to figure out, well, what can we do about that to sort of make those social connections between those of us who have so much and help the others take advantage of the opportunity that's here.
Absolutely, yeah. The poor are right here. They are in our communities. That's right. Well, what this does is mostly open up new questions and questions to wrestle with instead of having lots of answers. But so maybe that's an appropriate place for us to end the morning session with continuing to wrestle with this question. How do we practice our faith in the midst and with these persons who are us as well? Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.